Hello, folks, and welcome to Strong Tower Radio Features. I'm your host, Tom Majeur, and we're going to talk about migration with Dr. Gordon Atkins. He's at Camp Asabo up in Grayling, Michigan. Welcome, Dr. Atkins.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be back.
This is part of a series of migrations. There's more to migrations than meets the eye.
It's a fun time, and this time of year is especially important. So,
and those who have been with us in the past, or you could go to str.fm and look at some of the historical programs. But we're talking about a series here. Migration takes place at two different times of year, correct?
Yes, spring and fall, and of course in springtime now, so the ducks have been moving through, and now it's time to be looking for another group.
Okay, well, stay tuned, folks. We're going to talk about that other group. Dr. Atkins, would you lead us in a word of prayer?
Sure. Our Father in heaven, we just thank you for your creation, for the things that you have made, for our lives, and the fact that we can interact with those things and learn about you through looking at your creation. We pray that you'll be with us in our discussion of what's moving through right now. We pray in Jesus' name.
Amen. I'm going to kind of bait this question with, are all birds the same?
Well, if you're a birder, you'll like them all, but no, not all birds are the same.
And so do they migrate differently?
Yes, there are some general rules that are followed, but different groups of birds have preferences, and then even individuals within those groups can be rather unique.
So I assume that some migrate farther than others?
That's true. There are some rather short migrations, the order of just, well, if you're up in the mountains, some migrate down to the valleys for winter, so they don't have very far to go at all. Okay. But some change continents, so they are really moving.
Well, that's kind of the beauty, that the diversity that God has created is just marvelous.
In fact, as soon as you go to make a rule about something, there are all the exceptions. So it's almost a case-by-case basis, but that also makes it interesting. It's always something new.
Absolutely. So we have a spring migration we established in a fall migration, and then within those migrations, there's a sub-migration.
That's right. Different groups of birds or other animals. We're not just restricted to birds, but there are groups that, you know, earlier part of the spring, some that linger till later and so forth. And so while we talked about ducks being some of the earliest migrants, the next big group is the topic for today, and that's the shorebird migration.
All right. What is a shorebird? You know, I go to the beach and I think I know what a shorebird, but I'm going to leave the answer up to you.
Well, shorebirds are often found at the beach, but there are other things at the beach that aren't shorebirds.
Okay.
And not all shorebirds live at the beach. So
that sounds like that exception to the rule.
Yeah. So it's really a diverse group of birds. Some of them are called sandpipers. Some are called plovers. There's interesting ones called phalaropes. They generally have thin bills. Some of them are quite long. They use those for probing around in the water and the muck and the sand to find the little invertebrates they're eating.
Versus the ducks that have the broader bills.
A broader bill for filtering, yes. So the thin bill, but also long legs because they're often in water or mucky conditions. So the
I suppose if you had fat, stocky legs, as the waves come in, you kind of get washed about.
Well, that too. I think the long legs just allow them to probe out into deeper water without having to swim. And they also usually have fairly long, pointy wings, as far as birds go, and a slender body. And the combination of slender body and long, pointy wings allows them to fly very fast.
Okay, so could you name some of those types of shorebirds?
Sure. Well, probably the most common one you're going to encounter in Michigan isn't on the shore.
Oh, no.
But it is a shorebird, and that's the killdeer.
Okay.
And we have killdeers in our lawns, and just about anywhere you can hear a killdeer flying by. They're one of the shorebirds.
So how did they get in this group?
They've got the long legs. They have a really long bill, but they have the long pointy wings, fast flyers, and they fit in this broad category. So like I said, not all shorebirds are on the shore.
Okay.
But they have similar behaviors.
We learned something here on this program.
So yeah, there's lots of others. Probably if you are in Michigan on a canoe, on a lake or a river, one of the ones that actually will breed here in Michigan is the spotted sandpiper.
Okay.
They often are seen by themselves in the summer during breeding season, but you can always tell them by their very stiff wings, and they just fly over the surface of the water, flap, 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 stop, flap, 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 stop. And they also, when they're on land or in the shallow water, they bob their tail constantly. Okay. So if you see this thing that looks like it's about to tip over, it's probably a spotted sandpiper.
All right. Now, let me ask you a question. What's the difference between a sandpiper, a plover, and the phalaropes? That one's new to me.
Well, plovers tend to have shorter, slightly flattened bills, laterally flattened bills, but they have the long legs, and they're really quite similar, and the difference between all the variation of sandpipers into plovers is not all that striking, but they are shorter builds of the shorebirds. Phalaropes are interesting in that they do a lot of swimming. A lot of people think, well, it's a small little duck or a duckling, but no, it's a shorebird out in the water. They have a really curious feeding behavior because they've thin bills, not really long, but they'll swim around in tight circles or run around if the water's shallow in very tight circles to stir up the microbes and then find them. And so a flock of 100 can stir up more than one. So they get into these big groups and just they're all just running in circles, but they're feeding and stirring up food and basically helping each other find nourishment.
Well, some of these tips are going to help us when we try to identify them.
Some of the behaviors are really important because, unfortunately, they are difficult to identify sometimes. Some have distinct markings, but you have to pay close attention to the bill shape and size.
That's a key factor.
And the color.
Color.
Another one is the leg color.
Okay,
that can become really important in distinguishing some of the very similar ones. And it really gets bad in the fall migration because they go through a plumage change. They lose their breeding plumage. And the winter plumage, unfortunately, for almost everybody is brownish gray.
So they all look alike.
They get a lot harder to figure out. So then the profile and their behavior and some of these other things become really important.
So that gives me a hint that if you want to identify them, add them to your bird list. Spring is a better time.
It's always a better time during breeding season with the breeding plumage compared to winter.
Now, how big is this group of shorebirds? How many types are there?
There are 81 shorebirds in the Americas.
Do I have to remember all those?
No.
Okay.
Some of them are very common and are often seen. Others are going to be really hard to track down, and they land up in the rare bird reports when someone sees one.
And everybody gets excited in the bird world.
Well, and the other thing, too, is shorebirds, they do travel in numbers of the same species, but they'll also travel in mixed flocks. So you see a flock fly in and land on the shore, it may be one type or it may be a half a dozen different ones that you have to sort out. So
you just complicated things for me.
It's a lot of people just kind of shrug and they say it's a shorebird and they don't go any further, but they're missing out on a lot of fun.
All right. Hey, how many of these 81s in the Americas, I suppose that's North and South America.
Correct.
How many of them are local in our area?
Well, we have a few that breed in Michigan. We hardly have any that stay over winter. Maybe in some urban areas, someone may land up with a killdeer that spends the winter, but that's going to be a pretty miserable killdeer. So we have a few that nest here, but almost all of the shorebirds winter far south and breed farther north. So we get them in the spring, the month of April, which is why we're talking about them.
All right. So it's important that you prioritize. If you want to see shorebirds, you look them this month.
This month is the time.
All right. Now, I'm kind of going off the deep end here, but if I'm walking along Lake Michigan or Huron or Superior, there are some birds always, it seems like there's always shorebirds there to some extent.
Yes. Well, here's what's interesting is they come through in April. They're desperate to get up to the tundra because that's where most of them nest. Why go all the way up to the Arctic tundra?
How far is the Arctic tundra? 1,000?
Several thousand miles.
Wow.
Okay. So these guys will often, they'll typically migrate 3,000 to 6,000 miles. So they're way up there. And one of the reasons is that the tundra is, if you've been up there, is just full of all sorts of puddles. It's little small lakes and puddles and ponds. And so it's basically all shoreline up there.
Okay.
And not deep. And so they're beautifully adapted to finding food in those ponds.
Could some of that be permafrost that the moisture stays?
The moisture stays on the surface because of the underlying permafrost.
That was a good guess.
Yeah, right on. And the thing is, of course, that far north in the summer, it's daylight essentially all day long. And so they can gather food. And of course, because of all the shallow ponds, there's a lot of insects. So, and they all come out at the same time because the snow has just melted. Lots of food, concentrated area all day long to raise your young. They go up there, they nest, they breed very quickly, and they're on their way back.
What time is that?
As early as July.
Wow.
You can start getting birds coming back. So when you're walking along the beach in the, quote, summer, it's already fall for them and they're on their way back.
No way.
It's quite common to see these little shorebirds on their way back. Now, there are some that breed here, and probably the most famous ones on the beaches are the ones that close the beach and you can't walk on that part of the beach, and that's the piping plover.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Small little one. They're struggling in terms of numbers, and the Great Lakes shorelines, especially the gravelly shores, are good breeding grounds for them. And so when there's an area, and they tend to like to use traditional spots, so those areas get closed down during the critical nesting season.
Could you name a couple of those?
There's quite a few places. On Lake Superior, there are several specific ones down in the lower peninsula. In the Holland area, some of the beaches there get closed off. There are some up in Manitou Island, just off of Traverse City and up that way. There are some on the Lake Huron side too. Tawas Point has some. And even down closer to Detroit, some of those beaches will have, not the whole beach closed down, but a section. And research has shown that the areas where they close down the beach and have less traffic, those birds have considerably more body weight than the ones that are always getting disturbed and flying off. They're just not able to eat as often, and so they just don't do as well.
Are we having any progress in restoring the population?
Yes. From when we first started, when I say we, ecologists decades ago, started recognizing the importance of the beaches to the piping plover, our numbers are up.
Good. Glad to hear that. Wow, I noticed here in our notes that those migrations go to the Gulf Coast. Is that along the Caribbean?
Many of these birds, like I said, nest in the Arctic tundra, and they winter on the Gulf Coast of the U.S., of Texas Gulf Coast and Florida, down into the Caribbean. But a lot of them cross over the Atlantic waters into the northern parts of South America, and some go even further. Sort of the north shore of South America is an important part. There are several large rivers there that open up into deltas before they hit the ocean, and that's just a great place to be a shorebird. And so they gather there in large numbers. So now in the spring, they're on their way back. And it's interesting that they kind of, most of the shorebirds sort of fly east as they're going south. So they're going southeast to the coastal areas like Delaware Bay. That's a big stopover point. And then they work their way down and then fly across either the Gulf of Mexico or the Atlantic to South America. But on their way home, they often fly further west
and really
come up through the central part of the U.S.
So like the Mississippi.
Through the plains and the Mississippi and central flyways on their way up to the tundra.
Wow.
And so that's when we actually see most is in the spring, because in the fall, they're kind of
further west.
Well, they've kind of already gone east instead. You know, some of them cross over Michigan, but a lot of them will kind of fly right over us to Delaware Bay. And on the way back up, they kind of come through the central part. And the Great Lakes is a big body of water and a lot of shoreline. So
okay,
the Great Lakes in Michigan, since we're surrounded by Great Lakes, is a good spot to see them.
That's why Labor Day weekend, I probably see quite a bit of them.
That's true.
Well, great. Well, Dr. Atkins has been with us. He's a nature guy at Camp Asabo and also is affiliated with Andrews University and doing tours and stuff. We'll be back, and we're talking about spring shorebirds migration.
When you're taking a trip, it's important to stay on the right road and to follow the GPS or roadmap to be sure that you get to your destination. Likewise, on your trip to heaven, it is vital to follow the roadmap, the Bible, God's positioning system. To do that, stay with Strong Tower Radio as we uplift the Bible and proclaim God's character. If you'd like to help with this mission, go to our secure website, strongtowerradio.org and click on the donate button, or call 231-468-2087. We thank you and may God bless you as we proclaim God's character together.
We're back with Dr. Gordon Atkins from Camp Asabo, and he's the nature guy, and we're doing a series on migration, the spring and the fall migration, and today we're talking about the shorebirds. Dr. Atkins, how do we know what we know about shorebirds?
Well, one of the most interesting things is to look at their migration, where they come from, where they go to, and we've been limited for quite a while to just banding birds and hopefully finding them or recapturing them and reading the band.
Which is a lot of trouble.
It's a lot of work, and all that tells you is the bird that used to be there was now here, but it doesn't tell you how it got there.
What he did in between.
Right. Now, what has really helped with our understanding of migration is the development of the cell phone. The little accelerometers in there so that the phone knows you're moving and knows how fast you're going down the highway and all those kind of things. They've been miniaturized to get into to be put into a cell phone, and little miniature batteries and little miniature circuits.
So you're saying these birds have cell phones?
They have the
technology.
The technology of your cell phone is attached to the leg of a little shorebird.
Wow.
And so these geolocators.
How come my phone, when it gets wet, it doesn't work?
It's the other parts that don't work well in the water. But the locator, it's embedded in plastic. But that, in conjunction with satellite tracking, we can follow a bird's moment-by-moment movements.
Sounds like
know whether it's flying, know whether it's sitting, walking, swimming. We can really now learn a lot about their movements.
Sounds like this is huge. I mean, what you're telling us about this migration pattern has opened my eyes immensely.
This has been a breakthrough in studying migration, because now we've got specifics, and there's all sorts of interesting statistics that have come out from this about how birds fly and migrate. So one of the things we learned is just their speed. We had a pretty good idea, but most of them cruise at about 60 miles an hour. So they're moving fast, and that has to do with the body shape we mentioned earlier, the long wings and the slender body. They can really fly fast. And what that means is we wondered whether they just flew for a while and rested and ate and then kept going. We have now learned that some of these shorebirds, the bar-tailed gotwit is one of the bigger ones. It has been known to fly 6,500 miles nonstop.
That's a record.
That's day and night for several days.
That's more than I can do.
Yeah. And so these guys migrate from Alaska down to New Zealand. They really travel a distance.
They have to make time.
Yeah. And then there's others that it's not uncommon for them to go 10,000 miles with maybe one or two breaks. And so it's amazing how efficient they are at flying. But of course, that takes energy. And so what we also know from ground studies is these birds have to double their fat content before they take off. So they're kind of doubling their body weight, but their metabolism is amazingly efficient, but fast. For example, a human biking in the Tour de France, they've done studies on those. Their metabolism for that day when they're racing is about five times the normal resting metabolism. And in these birds, we find that it's nine times the metabolism rate.
That's working against them.
Well, that allows them to generate the energy to flap those wings so many times to go.
Now, let's talk about their eating. It doesn't sound like they take too many rest stops. They pass a few.
Yes. So these ones that do like the 6,000-mile nonstop, they've got to fuel up for several days before they take that trip. And then they're going to stop and have to spend a lot of time filling up the tank again. And there's one statistic where they did a study on one species. It was eating one of their favorite fruits is the eggs of invertebrates like horseshoe crabs. And this one that they were studying, and I forget which species of shorebirds it was right now, but it was eating one egg every 5 seconds. So they're probing around looking for a horseshoe crab egg, eating one every 5 seconds.
Is that why you see them bobbing like
that? Up and down, yeah. They're just probing around. They find something. They swallow it so fast you hardly see it.
That's in the up motion, probably.
Up it comes and then down away they go again. So they do that for 14 hours. So eating an egg every 5 seconds for 14 hours, and they'll do that for several days.
Wow.
So they're eating machines as well as flying machines, and they have to alternate between the two because it just takes a lot of energy. Yeah, that was a sanderling. That's one of the little shorebirds that was studied. And they're one of the smaller ones. In fact, the sanderling is the little white ones you often see going back and forth with the waves on the beach.
Oh, yeah, up and back.
Up and back. They don't like to get wet, but they want to get the food right there where the water is.
As soon as it washes up on the beach.
The eggs are going to be more visible at that time. So, yeah, how they do it is, you know, because of their dynamics, because of their fat stores, they're, you know, feeding for long periods of time before they go. And if you're going to fly for 6 days straight, you have to be able to sleep while you're flying.
Wow.
Okay. So
that's efficient.
Yeah. They do what scientists called hemispheric sleep. So one hemisphere of the brain goes to sleep, the other's awake. They do the navigating, they, avoid obstacles, and then it switches to the other side and it goes to sleep and the other side rests. And it goes back and forth many times, depending on the bird. Usually the smaller birds switch back and forth every few minutes. Larger birds will switch back and forth maybe every half hour.
Hmm. We hear about that in whales.
It's the same thing like mammals that need to breathe. They can't fall asleep down underneath. So if you're flying, you can't fall asleep either.
So what is the best? Let's talk about viewing these birds. You've tantalized us with these amazing statistics. We want to go see these birds.
Sure. So shorebirds can be found on shorelines.
Most shores.
Most shores. Not all. And you can go to one area and you'll see nothing, and you'll go to another area and you may see hundreds.
Okay.
So you're going to find the right place. But certainly the shorelines of the Great Lakes are an important part, as we mentioned, coming up through the central states, the shorelines of Lake Michigan and Huron and even Superior are great places for them to gather and feed. But also shorelines and shallow waters of any inland pond or lake during the spring in Michigan is a good spot. And even just a flooded farm field.
Hmm.
In fact, flooded farm fields can be some of the best places to
see
shorebirds.
Because it's not very deep.
It's not very deep. And if it's drying up from, the winter
melt,
it concentrates the invertebrates that are growing in the water. And so it makes it easier for them to find. So they prefer the falling water levels in a shallow pond because it concentrates things really well.
I could see that in the plains of Illinois would be some good.
Oh, absolutely. There are farming areas in the spring before things get planted are big spots. And in fact, in areas where they're trying to sort of reestablish habitat, they'll specifically, build dikes and flood fields on purpose.
Like rice paddies.
Exactly. And so that it attracts the birds they land down. Now, some of the shorebirds actually don't really like the water. I shouldn't say don't like the water, but they don't have to have the water. And so a corn stubble field could have a flock of several hundred black-bellied plover or a bunch of killdeer or a flock of both. And so you don't have to have water, but pretty much it's got to be flat.
Okay.
Flat is important because, they're probing around in the soil. And so shallow water or a mucky field, that's a good spot. Now, go ahead.
I was going to say, where do we find them?
Right. So in Michigan, we've described generally where you could do that. So that really sounds like almost anywhere except a city block. But there are some locations that have been traditional spots for lots of birds to land. In southwest Michigan, the Berrien County shorelines of Lake Michigan are really pretty good. And one of the reasons is, if you think of where that is, it's right down at the southern edge of Lake Michigan.
Correct.
So the birds that are flying north, that's kind of the first Great Lake they encounter.
First rest stop.
That's a good stop if they haven't already stopped on flooded fields along the way.
Right.
And then, of course, that area has a lot of the sand dunes. In fact, that area of Michigan that's our largest freshwater sand dunes anywhere.
Oh, wow.
Is Lake Michigan. So that's cool. And the big sand dunes then trap water from that it's trying to get to the lake. And so you have all sorts of ponds on the other side of the
first dunes.
So you got water on one side of the dunes and then shallow water accumulating on the other. And both of those locations can be really good. A bit further north, we've mentioned this before with the ducks, the Muskegon County wastewater system up there just east of Muskegon has a lot of shoreline by its design of being evaporation ponds, and a lot of shorebirds accumulate there. And on the east side, you've got Lake Huron and all its shorelines and shallow beaches. So anywhere up there. Now, the one thing that really helps is if you've got shoreline and protection. So a harbor, those kind of things can accumulate. And then up in the UP, you've got Whitefish Point and all the shoreline on Lake Superior. So there's lots of places to go. They're not always going to be there. So sometimes you'll have to go back to the same place. You may look at a puddle and there'd be nothing, and you come back the next day and it's just full of little guys crawling around.
So which weeks of April are the best?
Again, within the whole shorebird group, some are early and some are late. So all through April, you'll have different species coming through.
Wonderful. And there's an opportunity to come. We've been really looking forward to. We've asked Dr. Atkins if there's some way that our listeners can join with him and look at these shorebirds. And we have a date that's coming up, and tell our listeners about how they can join you for a day looking at shorebirds.
Yeah. So we are, I work at Camp Isabel as the naturalist there. So we're having one of our Camp Isabel nature tours, as we call it, just a day trip down to Muskegon County wastewater system. That's April 22. And we're just going to meet there in the morning and spend the day driving around the dikes and looking in the grassy areas too, because there's a few that don't like the water, but they're there too. So it gives us an opportunity to look at shorebirds. Usually there are also a lot of the ducks we talked about last month still hanging around. And so there'll be a lot of duck species and a lot of shorebird species.
Looks like a wonderful opportunity. That's campisabel.org. And you can go on that, and you need to register ahead of time. But it's April 22nd at the Muskegon Wastewater Treatment Plant, and it really doesn't smell that bad.
It sounds bad, but I even know birders who've proposed to each other at a settling pond. So it's survivable.
Absolutely. And so please go on campisabel.org, and you have a chance to meet Dr. Atkins in person. And it's going to be a great time. And we'll be going in caravans. There'll be walkie-talkies, so Dr. Atkins can help direct our attention and actually identify.
Yeah, bring your binoculars if you have them, and we have extras if you don't. And we'll have a couple spotting scopes for those that are way off in the distance and hard to see.
Absolutely.
When you go to the site, if I just mentioned, you should pull down the Nature Tour tab, and that will give you contact information.
Fantastic. The Nature Tour tab at campisabel.org. And this has been Strong Tower Radio Feature with Dr. Atkins, the Nature Guy. Stay tuned for the rest of the migration series. Bye now.